month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 17th, 2017. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Open Source Bridge Conference, June 20th to 23rd at the Elliott Center in Portland. Open Source Bridge is a conference for developers working with open source technologies and for people interested in learning the open source way. The conference has five tracks connecting people across projects, languages, and backgrounds to explore open source. Again, that's the Open Source Bridge Conference, June 20th to 23rd at the Elliott Center, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers. My guest is Victoria Stoppiello. Since 1996, she has been an essayist, news and feature writer for the Chinook Observer and other publications. She has also been a very important figure in the history of KBOO Radio as the station manager when KBOO bought and remodeled the building that we are in right now in 1982. Yep. She also returned to be the manager two other times. Mm-hmm. Victoria was born and raised in the Lower Columbia region. After living in Berkeley, Boulder, and Portland, she moved to the Northwest Coast in 1985. Her book of essays, which we are going to talk about in this interview, is called This Side of Sand Island, Reflections on Fish, Fins, and Finding Out About Family on the Lower Columbia. Victoria Stoppiello, welcome to Between the Covers.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about how this book got started. It is a collection of essays that originally were written for the
Chinook Observer.
Chinook Observer.
Right.
Talk about how it became a book.
A long time ago, before I started writing this kind of stuff, I was a watercolor painter, and I went through the workbook, An Artist's Way. And at one point, my husband and I were camping all up and down the eastern seaboard for about 5-6 months. We were living in Ilwaco, Washington, a historic fishing town on the Columbia. And I was journaling, because that's what the Artist's Way tells you to do. And I was doing this so I could become a better painter. And while I was doing this, I suddenly realized that my entire life I've been writing. I was a lit major at Cal, you know, so it's not like this is new. When we got back home, I took about 3 or 4 essays I had written about things I observed on the East Coast that applied to where I was living. Issues about aquifers in Florida pertains to all those little towns on sand spits where we live. And I took a few essays to the editor, and he said, I will give you a column and I will pay you. That's how it really started. And then a lot of time went by. I have somewhat of a following in terms of the newspaper's reach. And a few people said, well, why don't you put everything together in a book? And one of the essays was called This Side of Sand Island. My editor, Matt Winters, who's been very supportive and still is, said, hey, that's a great title for a book. And that just sat in the back of my brain for literally 15 years. And I thought, well, you know, I'm getting old enough, and if I'm going to do a vanity press thing like this, I better get my act together. So I went back over about 20 years worth of essays, and I selected the ones that fit together in a theme. And that theme is the thing about fish, because when you live in a salmon fishing town and you look at all the impacts, because salmon are sort of an indicator species for our whole watershed, the Columbia Basin watershed. And then fins, it was a Finnish American town. I'm a 100%er. And I was also in my dad's birthplace. Now, I never knew my dad till after I finished high school. So it was also a kind of a adventure finding out more about him, about he and my mother's relationship as it was seen by their contemporaries, just learning a whole bunch about a different side of Finnish-American culture than I had been raised with. that's the general thematic material. And I went through my essays. I picked out the ones that looked good. I engaged an editor, Nancy Slavin. She helped me make things easier to understand for people who weren't familiar with the geography. And then I also hired a young man, a book designer, Ryan Pedersen, and he did the book design with me. And I got some money from the Finlandia Foundation that helped pay the bills for all this. And hey, I made a little money.
Good. Now, let's talk a little bit about your background,
okay,
and particularly about how you came to live in your father's birthplace.
Okay.
And as you mentioned, you didn't really know your father,
right,
until you were an adult.
Right. Well, I was my father's only child. I have two half-sisters, and it was really me seeking him out after I had the freedom to do so. My mother was really ticked off. That's mentioned in the book. She was really mad about the divorce and mad at him. And other people said, well, you know, when you have a great love affair and then it crashes and burns, you can carry a lot of bitterness. And so that separated my parents, and my mother really couldn't handle the situation at all. And my mother's not in this book at all. And people who know me well are surprised by that. But it seemed like this book is not about her. If I went into that, that would be a much darker collection of essays. So I got to know him. And then when he passed away, I inherited the house that he was born in. He wasn't living in it, but my husband, who's an architect, the first time he saw this house, he was blown away. It's very traditional, Lower Columbia, 1.5-story, built by fishermen, plain little house in my eyes. But my husband looked at it and said, wow, this is a classic house. It has pre-Columbian siding on it, meaning the trees that produced the siding were standing before Columbus came to America. That's how old our forests were before we started cutting them all down. So I inherited the house, and after we were living in Manzanita, real estate was escalating like crazy. We had money in the bank, but we just were flummoxed. And then one day, on a camping trip, we went, what would happen if we took that money we have, moved to this little house in Ilwaco that has great southern exposure, and use that money to renovate the house? And so that's how we ended up there. And we lived in Ilwaco for 13 years.
You mentioned earlier that you had some help with addressing the issue that some people's geography of the Northwest is not that great.
Right.
So maybe talk a little bit about Ilwaco and where it actually is.
Oh, good idea. Yeah. So a lot of people are familiar with Astoria because it has a much more visible history. If you go across the river to Washington State from Astoria and you turn west and you go about 10 miles, you're at Ilwaco, which is a natural harbor, was a natural harbor until the Corps of Engineers got control of the Columbia. It's tucked behind Cape Disappointment, which is a volcanic headland. And it was the place where the Russians would stop and the Spaniards would stop and get fresh water. It's where the Chinooks were. It's this little town that's still intact. There's no strip malls, no big box stores. Heavily Scandinavian, mostly Finnish people. And it was the premier salmon port on the West Coast because all those salmon were headed for the Columbia. And from Ilwaco, it's about 2 miles to get out onto the ocean. A rugged 2 miles, but all the same, very, very close. So it's west of Astoria substantially and north.
The title of the book, as we've said, This Side of Sand Island, it is an essay in the book, and it is an important idea in the mm-hmm. book, that this whole changing of Sand Island mm-hmm. and how it affected the community. Can you talk about the significance of Sand Island?
Sure. Well, there's two Sand Islands, but the one you can see from Ilwaco is really close. It was literally a rowboat ride for a skilled oarsman. And it keeps moving in the channel, and it belongs to Oregon. The Columbia is about 4 miles across at that point. And so if Sand Island is 0.5 mile from the Washington shore, that means there's 3.5 miles of Oregon water before you hit Oregon. And in the old days, long before we started changing what the river did, the channel, if you were in a ship or a boat and you were going from the Pacific Ocean up to Portland, you would have come very close to Ilwaco. You would have been north of Sand Island. That was the old channel. It curved and bent in certain ways, and even now you can see the ships, you know, really wobble as they go upstream. But what's happened is we've dredged the Columbia to make it really straight and easy for really big ships. And as a result, the old channel is really a backwater. And in some ways, that's the metaphor for what's going on for the fishing communities on most of the West Coast. Nobody's thriving doing fishing. And things are better than they were in the 80s, but it's still not thriving. And so, yeah, Ilwaco is a backwater in that respect.
Yeah, talk about Ilwaco and the decline of the salmon fishing industry and mm-hmm. and how the town has been affected. And
of course, people will talk about overfishing, and they'll talk about fish traps and things that were going on, fish wheels that were happening more than 100 years ago on the Columbia. I mean, there was intense fishing took place, and that clearly must have affected the runs. But the biggest changes were when we began damming the Columbia. And some of the dams had really inadequate fish passage arrangements. And the most notorious one is Grand Coulee. There used to be fish routinely that would spawn upstream of Grand Coulee Dam, and it's hundreds of miles. And the way fish salmon operate is the further they have to go to get to their spawning grounds, the bigger they get. And those fish were your size, my size. We're talking about 85-pound salmon that used to go up past Grand Coulee. Well, Grand Coulee has no fish ladders. And perhaps if we ever built some fish, because they're like everybody else, we'll look for more habitat, we'll go up there. But the dam building had a huge, huge impact. And the commercial fishing organizations produced some literature, some pamphlets before Bonneville Dam was built, predicting exactly what has happened. Not a total crash in the population, but definitely a decline in the number of salmon. And it's not just having to have a fish ladder for the big fish to go out. It's also so that the small fish, they tend to follow the current to get to the ocean. And that means very often they go right through the turbines. And that's why we have these crazy programs where we put small fish in barges and we barge them around the dams and then drop them back into the river.
In one of your essays, you quote your husband as he walks the beach and picks up aluminum cans,
right.
And he calls them smolts.
Yeah, those are the little fish that are usually spend some time in brackish water getting their strength before they hit the ocean. Yep.
And he likens them to the cans because the cans, the product, the aluminum product has a connection.
Right. And that has changed. You see, McNary Dam was built just for Alcoa Aluminum to make cans. And Alcoa, and there's all kinds of politics around energy and what Alcoa did with its electricity at some points. Now that electricity isn't going for that. It's going for clicks on Facebook. Mm-hmm. That's what's going with our excess power. It's not even producing something tangible. It is supporting the whole internet. That's why we have big server farms east of the Cascades, because there's cheap power from the hydro system. And more recently, I wrote one piece about that too, about, well, I used to complain that excess power from the Bonneville system was going to Las Vegas and LA to light up crazy stuff that didn't need to be lit. But now it's lighting up Facebook and Google searches and everything else, because that's where we're using our electricity now, our so-called surplus. So there's no free lunch. I wrote a piece, my most recent piece. Anthony and I bought an all-electric car in December. First new car in my life. Very exciting for us. Kind of almost an impulse buy. But, you know, we can get to Portland in one charge. And I wrote an essay about this, and I got a letter from a guy who is an EV advocate big time, and he really scolded me for saying that I was driving a fish-killing car. And, of course, I was poking fun at the idea that we think, oh, well, now I'm not putting out greenhouse gases. This must be a free lunch, right? Well, there's no free lunch. There's always some something's got to give.
Yeah. So. This is Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm speaking with Victoria Stoppiello. We're talking about some of the ideas and essays in her latest book. It's called This Side of Sand Island. We've been talking a lot about the environmental themes in mm-hmm. the book, mm-hmm. but it's also quite personal, and I think that's what makes it unique, is that your reflections kind of connect environmentalism and personal things that happen. And one of the things that you say in the introduction is that there's a connecting theme of loss. Can you talk more about that, how that connects some of these things?
One of the things that I lost was the experience of knowing my father when I was a young person. And that was a shame, because what I found when we moved to Ilwaco, his hometown, that he was very well regarded. He was the first All-State basketball player from Ilwaco High School, you know, and people remember that. And he was an outstanding athlete, you know, a four-sport athlete kind of guy. But he was also very fair-minded. He was known for a reasonable amount of integrity. People would light up when they realized that I was his daughter. I mean, it was clearly I got a certain kind of cachet from that. And that's certainly a loss. I think it's a loss. I actually feel wistful sometimes when I see fathers with their children out playing in a park or walking a trail, you know, up Neocony Mountain or something else. And I think, well, there's an aspect of life that I never mm-hmm. got. And of course, I've sentimentalized many things about my dad and about his lifestyle as a commercial fisherman. But that's one part of the loss. The other thing was to see how, not in despair, but sad and despondent. There's nothing like a commercial fisherman who can't fish or finds that they can't afford to fish because of the cost of boat upkeep and all of that. People who fish commercially, almost to a man, have a certain aesthetic connection with the natural world. Yeah, they're out there to make a living. Now, most of the guys that I've talked to are one boat, one man operators. You know, they're working with like a 38-foot wooden troller or something like that. Those are the kind of people that I got to know. And they're still at it. They're still doing that. I just met a man through Facebook who owns my dad's first fishing boat, the Victoria. And through this weird connection of this writing, found out about me just like 6 months ago. For all those people, there's a sense of loss. I know men who fish in Alaska and talk about, hey, you know, yeah, there's the tedium of waiting for the fish to strike, but there's also incredible beauty that most of us who live in urban situations don't get to experience. And to have that pulled away. And now, Governor Kitzhaber suggested that all the gillnet fishermen should be taken off the river, which, as far as I was concerned, was just a sellout to the sport fishing tackle industry, because it's just sort of saying, well, blue-collar lifestyles supported by commercial fishing aren't worth it. We'll just take them out of the game. And it was sold as a conservation effort. No, they just gave all the commercial share to the sports industry. It's still going on. It's sort of, it's one of those urban, you know, people from Portland drive down and camp, you know, at the Lower Columbia and go fishing on the ocean, and it's a sport for them. It's fun for them. It's a vacation. It's not making a living. So that's part of our urban-rural split is taking place with that, too. So that's a loss. And then, of course, there's the big picture, which is the degradation of the whole Columbia watershed. I don't know, is there 78 dams in the on the watershed? I mean, it's just like, you know, we have industrialized the Columbia River. There's many impacts from that, some of which we don't even totally realize. You know, like Hanford is leaking into the Columbia, for example. So we have loss on personal levels and also big, way beyond us, yeah. Irreparable, perhaps.
Your father was a troller. Mm-hmm. Your grandfather was a gillnetter.
Correct.
He was Finnish,
right.
And Finns, as is reflected in the subtitle of this book, Reflections on Fish, Finns, and Finding Out About Family on the Lower Columbia. Finns are a theme in your
mm-hmm.
book.
Right.
The community you had in Ilwaco, the Finnish community, mm-hmm. and also your own background and finding out some connections to Finland yourself.
Right.
How does the Finnishness play out in the community of Ilwaco? What do you want to capture about that when you write about the Finns in the area?
My perspective has been a bit altered since I wrote these, because in 2015, Anthony and I went to Finland for 5 weeks, and I had one cousin on my dad's side to connect with, but through her, I met more cousins and more cousins and more cousins, and I've come to realize it's not just that community. I was raised in a very intensely Finnish family on my mother's side. I just wrote an essay for Upper Left Edge that I submitted to the editor talking about what it is to be a Finnish person. And I've come to realize that I'm a little bit like, you know, does a fish know about water? Nah. You know, do I know about how Finnish I am? And when I went to Finland, it was so comfortable, it was ridiculous. the way of being. And when I look back on our Ilwaco experience, which is more than 10 years ago, Finns have this sort of diffident, not necessarily closed expression, but there's a term in Finnish, sisu, about being able to endure things. And by the way, building Kebu Studios, that sisu came in very handy, which is keep your mouth shut when you want to strangle somebody. And, you know, just kind of bear up under stress. But I ended up being on the Planning Commission for 7 or 8 years and then on the City Council in Ilwaco. And I think that my Finnishness assisted me in terms of just, you know, stay calm. I mean, I could get very fiery, as you know from our other experiences together. But the town is very subdued. One of our neighbors, who was an architect of Russian extraction, said, yeah, this town is never going to change until all the Finns die out. And I said, Mike, they're still being born. And, you know, so there's this rather, there's a very conservative element. And then going to Finland, you see there's a very conservative element, not politically conservative. There's social democrats, big time. But they're conservative in that if we're going to build a road, we're going to build it right. I mean, we drove 1,300 miles in Finland without a pothole. Zero. None. And this is, you know, extreme temperature changes and all that. So that kind of conservatism, like, okay, if we're going to do something, let's do it with some conscientious approach to doing it right the first time. And so there's a tendency not to change very quickly. There's a tendency to have this sort of very low-key sense of self-deprecating humor as part of Finnish culture. But what we also found in Finland is that as soon as we approached someone, they totally opened up to it. Total strangers on the street. You need directions? You go up to somebody who's under 50, they'll speak fluent English. It's one of the best English as a second language countries in the world. And as soon as you ask for some help, they just open arms, emotionally open arms. But that's not what you experience at, you know, first glance.
Mm-hmm.
What you're going to see is a sort of closed exterior.
Again, I'm speaking with Victoria Stoppiello. We're talking about this side of Sand Island, her collection of essays. We discussed earlier that you might read one of the essays, Victoria.
Sure.
The last essay in the book has a wonderful title.
Everything Flows By?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Can you read that now? Maybe
sure.
Tell us anything you want to tell us about it.
Okay. So this essay is Everything Flows By. And it kind of explains that geography question, too. When people ask me where I live, I tell them Ilwaco, Washington. Usually they don't know where that is, even if they live in the Pacific Northwest. Then I say, it's at the mouth of the Columbia River. I used to quickly explain where the mouth of the river is, shortcutting the inevitable. Is that near Vancouver? No, we're 100 miles further downstream. Oh, near Hood River. Now I wait while a person mentally stumbles through what little they know of Northwest geography or geographical terminology, words like river mouth, headwaters, gorge, delta, estuary, channel, slough, tributary, spit, wetlands, riparian zone, marsh. They get lost in words whose meaning they've never attached to a real place. I hang back partly to figure out how much awareness of river geography exists in the general population, and partly to let people figure it out on their own. Perhaps if they truly learn where a river mouth is, what an estuary is, they won't blindly accept the idea, for example, of dredging the Columbia River shipping channel an additional 3 feet deep from the mouth of the river all the way upstream to Portland. The best effort toward geographic understanding was from a fellow who said, "Is the mouth of the river the delta?" I responded, "Could be, depends on the river, but the Columbia has no delta. It's too deep and fast." The man traced in his mind the upstream course of the Columbia through the gorge past Hood River and kept going, turning north in a big bend into Washington, then further on toward Canada. Having mistaken the mouth for the headwaters, he realized his error because he knew I lived in Washington, not British Columbia. We visualized the river tracking past the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and noted the irony that this is one of the last remaining sections of free-flowing river, and salmon runs in that area are still pretty plentiful. But as one humorist mentioned, probably radioactive. The thing about living at the mouth of the river is that everything that happens to the river goes by your front door, either literally or figuratively. The salmon go up and the smolts come down. The ships go in and out. The tide, too, influences the river all the way beyond Portland. The only thing that comes our way on the river is what we dump in it upstream, whether radioactive wastes or PCBs or dioxin from paper mills or cow manure from every trickle that drips to the river or sewage effluent or bait box, fish guts and styrofoam cups or log booms broken apart by storms or picnic tables and plastic buckets set loose by spring floods. It all eventually goes downriver past us and out to sea, unless we're able to snag it from shore or a convenient boat. Most of it we don't want to bring ashore and hope the great ocean will somehow absorb and dilute it, if not cleanse it. Without meaning to, we're like the faithful Hindu of India, who believe that great river, the Ganges, will cleanse everything. Water purifies to the best of its ability. We take that for granted, even though if we look beneath the calm, glassy surface, we know better. Anything can be overwhelmed, even this great river. It's time to step back from our usual way of doing things, our modus operandi of the last 100 years. We can start with the obvious and easy, what some would call picking the low-hanging fruit. An example would be not doing any more destruction of the river as a natural system, not blasting and dredging the river deeper. At the next level would be repairing some of the damage, for example, by removing the 4 Lower Snake River dams, allowing the salmon to reach a vast area of relatively untouched habitat in central Idaho. Like everything else that goes up and down the river, those Idaho salmon will swim right past us here at the mouth of the river. I remind myself that anything that happens to the river impacts me, and some of it might as well be good.
That was Victoria Stoppiello reading from her book of essays, This Side of Sand Island. I have been talking with Victoria Stoppiello, who has a long-time involvement with KBOO and has written a collection. Well, she's collected her essays that she wrote previously for the Chinook Observer into a book. It's called This Side of Sand Island. Victoria, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. And by the way, my original print run was 250 books, and I think I have 35 left. So you can get a hold of me on the web. I'm not hard to find. And if someone's interested in a copy, they can just get a hold of me.
Great, great. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers on KBOO Radio. If you missed part of this interview or want to hear it again, you can go to KBOO/Between the Covers sometime later today, and it should be available to you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Black Women for Peace 2017 Peace Festival on Saturday, June 24th at 5 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory in Portland. The fourth annual Peace Festival, We Stand for Peace, will feature music, spoken word, dance, and more from culturally diverse artists. Again, that's the Black Women for Peace 2017 Peace Festival on Saturday, June 24th at 5 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 16th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 13th through 16th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. The Northwest String Summit is a four-day celebration of Americana and bluegrass music hosted by the Yonder Mountain String Band. Guests include Green Sky Bluegrass, Elephant Revival, Fruition, Blitz and Trapper, The Shook Twins, and many, many more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 13th through 16th at Horning's Hideout, 21277 Northwest Brunswick Canyon Road in North Plains, Oregon. More information about the festival performers, parking, and admission can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and we're spending the half hour at Portland International Airport. I'm not taking a journey anywhere out of town. We're taking a journey into the Northwest filmmaking experience and film exhibition experience. So I'm standing outside the Hollywood